You might recall that last week I was talking to Peter Godwin, about his book The Fear, The Last Days of Robert Mugabe. On this occasion, we go back to that troubled land to talk to an equally remarkable Zimbabwean author, Douglas Rogers. When diamonds were found in a field near his ageing parents' farm in Zimbabwe, Douglas watched as everyone from the rural folks to goat herders to Mugabe's men piled in to get rich. Now, it's a heart-wrenching book, but it's quite funny, about his dad's battle to outwit Mugabe's cronies. And the book, is, as I said, is called The Last Resort, and Douglas joins me on the blower from New York. Douglas, would you be kind enough to describe the city where you were born? I've been to Zimbabwe many times, but never went to Mutare.
Mutare, hi Philip. It's a beautiful valley town on the eastern border of Zimbabwe, about 3 hours east of Harare, on the Mozambique border. And it's the fourth biggest city in Zimbabwe, it's kind of a large village, really, but a very beautiful place in the mountains.
Okay, now your parents owned a game park and a backpacker lodge called Drifters. Tell me about the property and the sort of people who worked and visited at the time.
Well, my parents, when my three sisters and I, we were born in born and raised in Zimbabwe, and my parents' ancestry and my father's ancestry goes back to South Africa in the 1600s. So we're white Africans of many generations. In 1990, my parents, when my sisters and I all left home and sort of bored of farm life, had moved to Europe or South Africa, my parents bought this plot of land on a range of hills, nothing on it, and decided to turn it into a backpacker lodge. And within 10 years, by the year 2000, or by late 1999, it had become a very famous resort on the Cape to Cairo Trail.
The Cape to Cairo Trail, yes, and you cracked it for the pages of the Lonely Planet Guide.
Yeah. It had reviews on the Lonely Planet. A lot of Australian visitors and New Zealand backpackers and British gap year students. It was a very popular place, and also with sort of farmers of the region. They lived in this beautiful farming valley. So a lot of farmers would go there and Western tourists. And it was incredibly busy and very popular.
Are we talking two-star, three-star? You know, was it modest and amiable?
It was very budget. My parents didn't really make much money from the place, but they sort of would have a pizza night on a Friday, and it was kind of like an extension of their living room, really. And four people put up a tent or just sit beers around the bar. Very laid back.
It sounds fun, but of course, following Mugabe's violent invasion of white-owned farms, most of which were then handed over to cronies rather than to people with any farming ability, the situation changes, doesn't it? And a lot of farmers, white farmers, fled the country. Why did your parents decide to stick it out?
Well, at the time, in 2000, I was living in London, and I was a travel writer and a journalist, and I was sort of horrified that my parents decided to stick it out and stay, but they're white Africans. They basically said, "We're Zimbabweans. This is our land. We built this out of nothing." I mean, there was nothing on that plot of land when they bought it, it was theirs basically. They were very lucky in many ways in that it wasn't obvious farmland. Across the road, a good friend of theirs was beaten up and attacked with an axe and lost his land, and all around them, friends and neighbors lost their farms. But my parents were lucky in that it was a tourist resort, and they were supposed to be exempt from expropriation. But as the book, as I sort of go back and forth from London and then New York to Zimbabwe and spend more time with them, I realize sort of other things about my parents that I didn't know and about my country. And one of the things is the sort of bloody-mindedness that my parents had, and the cunning and the tactics and the unusual methods my parents started using to keep hold of their place.
You also report that the drifters drift towards a status of informal brothel, the sanctuary where government-connected fat cats, the only people in the country with any dosh, bought prostitutes, mistresses and second wives.
Well, exactly. I mean, these were the things that I started to discover. I mean, I'd left Zimbabwe in my late teens, early 20s to live this exciting, adventurous life. And by the age of 30, I discovered my parents in Zimbabwe had an informal brothel. My father, at one point, decided to start growing marijuana to try and earn a bit of money. Then they'd walk around with a shotgun. And I realized that my parents, yeah, at the age of 70, were living a far more exciting and adventurous life than I was. I was the boring, staid sort of New Yorker.
Look, this is made for a feature film, isn't it, really? The property eventually falls into the hands of Mugabe's cronies, yes?
Well, no, it doesn't, actually. It is now owned by the government. What happened in around 2003 or 2004, a law was passed, basically meaning all privately owned white farms are vested in the president. And my father discovers this one day when he visits a lawyer, a planning official, who informs him basically that his property is no longer owned by himself. The government owns it. They just hadn't been removed yet. So then the book sort of takes on this extra sort of level of urgency, and it's about how the methods my father then takes to make sure that what's called an A2 farmer, the designated settler, doesn't arrive in his BMW and say, right, this is now mine. And one of these things that he did would be he'd go and see a local witch doctor. They started growing the bush on the property wild and incredibly sort of rough so that a vehicle passing by the road couldn't see them. So they were going back to bush. And another thing I discovered on these trips back was my parents now had frogs living in their house and cobwebs and were essentially sort of going back to the ways of the old pioneers.
They were fighting a sort of guerrilla war, weren't they? And you write about the hotel almost as a microcosm of your collapsed country. Your mother, for example, starts writing a cookbook called Recipes for Disaster, Adventures in the Kitchen of a Failed State.
Yeah, exactly. I'm actually pitching this right now, the proposal with my various publishers in London. But yeah, she has a whole recipe book of the extraordinary kind of things you have to do in order to cook a meal. One of the things I wanted to get across in the book was, I mean, we all hear about, I mean, everyone knows about Mugabe's a terrible man and the awful politics of Zimbabwe, of the country. But one thing that I wanted to get across was the amazing resilience and the kind of the humor that ordinary Zimbabweans have and had during this time, and the ability to adapt and survive. And one thing I would find going back was my father invented a sawdust stove, for example, from a tin can and a pile of sawdust. You realize you could actually cook meals on the kitchen floor, like slow cooked stews. And my parents would eat these amazing meals, and there was no food in the shops or in the supermarkets, but somehow they would do these amazing things to get hold of produce and cooking implements. Of course, by this time, there was no electricity in the country, so they needed to innovate and improvise.
Oh, Douglas, what a saga. I'm talking to Douglas Rogers on LNL, on Radio National and our various intergalactic platforms about his book, The Last Resort. Now, there's a wonderful twist in the plot, because something remarkable takes place in Mutare. The diamond trade arrives. Tell us about that.
This was incredible. I mean, late 2006, 2007, my parents basically their backpack and lodge, apart from even the sort of the prostitutes and the men who sort of would drive out now for these with their mistresses and second wives. That was their only business for about 6 or 7 years. And by 2007, the economy in Zimbabwe was so bad that there was no money for even this. So there was no one in their lodge, in their backpacker lodge, which is about half a mile's walk from their house. And then one afternoon or over a succession of weekends, my parents would go for a walk and suddenly discover all these vehicles in the parking lot and suddenly see that the bar was busy again with younger Zimbabweans, young sort of guys in their 20s and early 30s, and a different crowd to the men who would come for the prostitutes. And they were rather amazed by this, and they thought, how is this possible in Zimbabwe in 2007 when the economy is utterly sort of collapsed, no one has any money? And my father discovered this, the other unusual thing is that the vehicles that these guys had in the parking lot, slash new cars, some of them
BMWs, Mercedes.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And Nissans with personalised number plates, I like that.
Yeah, exactly. One guy had a 007 licence plate, and they discovered that these guys were diamond dealers. They were young Zimbabwean guys who months earlier were selling bread down back streets trying to eke out a living, but a diamond field had been discovered across the hills from our parents' farm. It was in an area called Marangi. And it is now, 3 years later, 4 years later, it's considered the biggest alluvial diamond field on earth. And the immediate consequence in 2007 was that thousands and thousands of Zimbabweans, many of them sort of unemployed teachers and doctors and nurses and engineers, flooded into this rural area and started digging for stones. And just one stone could change your life forever. And these guys, the same people, discovered my parents' lodge and turned it into their sort of, into their bar. And my parents sort of looked around and slightly sort of guiltily said, well, there's nothing we can do about this. It's good for our business. And it basically, their lodge has reinvented itself again. And I end up sort of becoming very good friends with one of these diamond dealers, a guy called Fatso.
Oh, yes. Well, this makes the thing even more cinematic. You know, the movie is unraveling in my head as we leap through this book. Fatso, the diamond dealer.
Fatso, yeah. It's funny, the BBC have just bought the film rights for my book and have a writer who's doing a script right now. So
Am I not a prescient presenter?
Yeah, you are, Philip. This guy Fatso is just an incredible character. He's become one of the biggest diamond dealers in the town. And starts hanging out in the lodge, and I meet him, and he's a good example of sort of what Zimbabweans did to survive. He used to be in the timber business, lost his job, had no money, had a family to support, and then within a space of a year, he became like a highly experienced gem dealer, teaching himself how to tell a stone, like a cut diamond from a flawless stone from an industrial stone, and carat and cut and light and weight. And these guys now they all want to become licensed diamond dealers, but at this time they were basically bandits. I mean, just trying to sort of avoid the soldiers and the police to get a bit of money. I mean, obviously what did happen in 2008, just after the very violent election, was that the military moved into that field and murdered about 300 people, gunned them down.
Another twist in the plot. Yeah. Now, we started the discussion with the charms of Mutare. How, in your eyes and those of your siblings, did the place change?
Over that period?
Yeah, I mean, Fatso drives you around and you get a glimpse into your former hometown.
Yeah. I sort of go and meet him one of these days in town and meet him outside the local ice cream parlor where my sisters and I would hang out. It's called the Dairy Den on the main street. And I remember my sister and I and our school friends would be there sipping sort of milkshakes. Now there's Fatso and his mates with gold jewelry and pumping hip-hop from their BMWs, and basically the local ice cream parlor had become the informal diamond dealer office restaurant on the main street of the town. So while these guys are there, the streets are all potholed, the shops have nothing in them, but you've got these young 20, 25-year-old kids driving around in BMWs on the street, using the ice cream parlour as their office.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me, Douglas, that this story, until you told it, hadn't really got out to the wider world. You know, it's not a part of the saga of Zimbabwe.
No, what I really wanted to get across in the book as well is that I think the story of Zimbabwe has been hijacked, largely, of course, because of who Mugabe is and what this ruling party have done to the country. But I think the outside world have played Mugabe's game by seeing it as a story about white and black and then colonialism. This is what Mugabe wants everyone to talk about. But in actual fact, another thing that I bring out in the book is the complete lie behind this idea of whites owning 70% of the land in the country. I mean, this is just nonsense. I mean, it's nowhere near the case. But people, and I think a lot in the West, love bringing up that, a lot, like playing that game. And what I wanted to bring across was, you know, like this is, it's the story of ordinary people living these extraordinary lives.
Well, not all ordinary. Let's go back to the extraordinary Fatso. Fatso's going to take you to the diamond fields. You don't make it on that trip because, suddenly he gets a phone call from his police contacts that there are roadblocks.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. The field was so rich, and the military and all the government were now discovering this. They had this massive security cordon put up around it, and typically you can't go in there. I mean, today I think the Chinese have an airstrip in there, and it's completely controlled by the military. But back then, you could get in if you had a contact on a roadblock. So Fatso and his mates and his syndicate would bribe the soldiers or the police and be able to get through. So I thought, like, I'm going to go out with him and check this diamonds put out, and we're on our way, him and a dealer, a friend of his, an Indian guy, and we're in the car, and suddenly their cell phones start ringing. They've got two cell phones each, and basically it's their informer, their policeman on the roadblock that we're supposed to go to, saying, well, they've sent down the secret police, the CIO, they've taken down this roadblock, you can't come in today. And we sort of swerved, went back into town. And I think there was a portent of what was to come in Morangi and Mutari over the next year, how violent it actually became.
I must admit I'm somewhat infatuated with Fatso. Did he survive all the political changes?
Well, I write in the epilogue of the book about how for about 6 months I lost touch with him. I never heard from him. I used to email a bit and never heard anything. And then in about early, maybe April 2009, I got an email talking about how the police and the soldiers had come, and special forces and commandos, and how people were killed. His words to me were, we were killed like flies. And he had gone into hiding. He had survived the military operation, which was Operation You Won't Come Back. And he had survived and gone into exile in Mozambique for a while, and then was in a safe house in Harare. But amazingly, he's back in Mutari now. A lot of these kids just blew their cash on booze and fast cars. He was quite clever. He saved his money and flew to China and bought himself a sawmill, and has now taken it back to Zimbabwe and wants to get back into the timber business again. So it's an incredibly resourceful guy.
And talking about incredible resourcefulness takes us back to the folks in the lodge, because by 2005, having avoided, like a lot of Zimbabwean whites, active involvement in politics, the lodge had become a meeting place for black political dissidents.
Yeah,
they would disguise themselves as priests.
Yeah, my father discovered this once. They got a call. So my mother, who's sort of a lapsed Catholic, lapsed Protestant, was horrified one evening to get a call from some people saying they wanted to rent the lodge out for the weekend. And my father sort of said, "Well, what are your names?" And the man said, "We're priests." And he said, "Yes, but what are your names?" He says, "We're just priests." And my mother thought, well, they're from a nearby church, and they want to come and cleanse the place, and sort of ask my parents to stop running this den of iniquity in the bush. But that weekend, my father goes down and he discovers they're dressed as priests, but they've taken off their dog collars and their Bibles are hollowed out on the side of the table by the bar, and basically they're MDC activists in disguise.
Douglas, I can't wait.
Political members.
I can't wait for the movie. But until it comes out, I recommend your book. Douglas Rogers' book is The Last Resort, an engaging pun, a memoir of Zimbabwe, published by Random House.